Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of CeraWe Conversations presented to you by IHS Market. And it's really a privilege for me to have two leaders of the power business with me, electric power business. First of all, I have Andrés Gluski, who is the president and CEO of AES. And then we have Mr. Mauricio Gutierrez, who is the CEO and president and CEO of NRG. So Andrés and Mauricio, welcome to CeraWe Conversations. Let's start with introducing a little bit about your companies to your audience. So Andrés, why don't I start with you? Could you just briefly introduce sort of the AES scope and span of your company and the footprint?
Sure. This is the Fortune 500 company. We are primarily contracted generation, long-term contracted generation, but we also own utilities. We're currently in 12 countries. We span all types of technologies except for nuclear. And we really are a global leader in the use of lithium-ion batteries for energy storage. And we're currently building almost 3 gigawatts of renewables a year. So we've made a big push into digital, into renewables, into energy storage, even though, you know, we still have a considerable 30 gigawatts of conventional energy. So we're in the midst of a transition.
Excellent. I'll come back to some of the things in a few minutes. So Mauricio, same question. Tell us about your scope and footprint.
Thank you, Phil. It's great to be here with you. And so NRG is a Fortune 500 company, but with operations primarily in the United States. We serve close to 4 million retail customers on their different brand names like Reliant, Green Mountain Energy, and NRG. And we have a generation portfolio that supplies electricity to those customers, close to 23,000 megawatts of generation, a very diverse portfolio from nuclear, coal, natural gas, solar storage. And so that's the scale and the scope of our operations.
Great. So let me stay with you, Mauricio. You know, power generation and electricity is considered an essential business. So how have you been operating in the midst of the COVID? Tell us a little bit about running the lights and keeping the internet on.
You know, when you think about it, perhaps as a sector and as a company, we're a little bit better prepared than other sectors. Our crisis management processes, business continuity, and you know, we also had our first share of natural disasters not long ago. I mean, I think everybody remembers Hurricane Harvey that hit our hometown in Houston. So, you know, that gave us an opportunity to really, you know, improve all those processes. So, you know, when this crisis happened, I think we were as ready as you can with the unprecedented situation that we're dealing with. I can tell you that the impact has been minimal on our operations. We have maintained full operational capabilities. As you know, the springtime is a very important time for the power industry, particularly the generation side of the industry, because that's when we do the maintenance on our facilities to get ready for the summer months where demand is the highest during the year. We also have worked very closely with our customers and our communities. I mean, recognizing that a lot of people are impacted by this pandemic, we paused all the electrical disconnects during that time to help our customers. And also we're working with our communities to providing support and relief to frontline workers. So I'm just incredibly proud of, you know, how the industry, you know, has stepped up to this challenge, not just energy, but the entire industry. And I think it's fair to say that electricity is one thing that people shouldn't have to worry about today.
Yeah, and it's proven to be the lifeline. So same question for you, Andrés, and perhaps you can talk a little bit also about your international operations outside of the U.S. How have you been doing?
Well, as Mauricio was saying, this is an industry which has had to face, you know, a number of natural disasters in recent years. It's also a industry which is very focused on the client, on serving. So this is an industry, quite frankly, in the U.S. where you have a tornado hit one state and we all send resources to help out that other fellow company. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it's unique. For us, it was very interesting because we were more probably a little bit ahead on the COVID-19 issue, maybe because of the international footprint. I mentioned it on my fourth quarter call that people had to prepare for COVID-19, and we were stockpiling photovoltaic cells, you know, inverters, et cetera, because of potential supply disruptions. And at the time, I was questioned a bit, like, why did I bring up this negative issue? But I'm very happy we did, because we had these contingency plans. The other thing that's been very interesting from a operational point of view, we had invested a lot in digital capabilities, in telepresence and things like what we're doing today. But we weren't using them as extensively as we are today. But actually, it was very easy for us. We took a decision the first week of March for all non-essential workers to work from home. And we really didn't have to buy any hardware or software or train anybody. But it's been very effective. I don't think we're ever going to go back to what we did before. The frontline people have done a fantastic job. And I'm also very proud of the fact that we have been able to maintain, or they have been able to maintain, COVID infections at very low rates. So out of 9,000 people, we've had 10 cases. Nobody ever passed through the hospital. Nobody's been seriously sick. You know, of the 10, 5 have recovered. Now, we've done a lot of testing. We did a lot of training, you know, in terms of proper hygiene, separation, face masks. But I think, you know, this has been really key to, you know, maintaining good operations.
Yeah, so a very well-prepared industry compared to many other industries, right? So, Mauricio, I want to come back to a related question around the generation mix. You already alluded to it, a change in the load, more residential demand than industrial demand. You know, we are seeing in the work we are doing at IHS Market that in some places, for example, in China, solar PV was dispatched in preference to coal. Have you seen something like similar in your operations? You know, different preferences for fuel mix?
Well, I mean, so the month that we have been impacted by is April. Usually demand for electricity in April is one of the lowest throughout the year. So let me start with what we're seeing on the different markets that we operate in terms of the impact to demand. And I think that is going to inform, you know, how it has impacted the generation side or the supply side of the equation. So when I think about the impact of to electricity, it's I think about it on a regional basis and then on a market segment basis. On a regional basis, the Northeast has been the most impacted by it, primarily the New York City area. We have seen electric load come down anywhere between 7 to 9%, and New York City, you know, upwards of 15%. So you can see the, you know, the significant impact in large metropolitan areas. California has been similar, anywhere between 7 to 9. But Texas, where we have most of our operations, has been incredibly resilient. For April, it was only down 2%. So that's the impact has been very, very regional. And that's the first thing that you need to appreciate about the COVID-19. The second one is the different customer segments. Obviously, the biggest impacted by all has been the small businesses. Because, I mean, with the stay-in orders, you know, they have to shut down all the small businesses. They have been the ones that have been hit the most. The one surprising thing, and I think, you know, all of you, you know, intuitively would have guessed, but not to the extent that it happened. Residential customers, actually, their consumption has increased. And particularly, I want to use Texas as an example because Texas has the highest penetration of smart metering, so we can actually read consumption of customers in real time. It's up 7% in April. So pretty significant increase in residential usage. And this is no surprise, right? I mean, we're all staying at home. We're using more electricity. You know, what is important to see or is how our consumption has changed. Usually in a normal day, you see people using a lot of electricity very early in the morning and then late in the afternoon when they come back to work. Now we're seeing that morning ramp happening a little bit later. So I think people are just staying in bed a little bit longer than normal. But you're seeing, you're seeing the morning wrap later. But demand, you know, more constant over the, you know, the rest of the day. You can imagine that renewables with zero variable costs are at the bottom of the stacking, you know, with nuclear. So we have seen a number of, gas coal units being backed down. But that's normal in a competitive market. That's what you would expect to see.
So Anders, I want to ask the same question to you, but also pivot a little bit to the longer term. Do you see this change in consumption patterns impacting your strategy into the future as well?
Yeah, look, our results are consistent with what Mauricio outlined, mm-hmm. you know, especially in the States, you know, our utilities in the Midwest. We've seen a significant drop of commercial and industrial. You've had a number of big automotive plants or automotive part plants in our service territory. And that has been offset by, you know, a rise of around 6% in residential. So you have seen that shift. Internationally, it's interesting. I mean, the results vary. You know, we've had countries that are only down 5%. We've had countries that are over 15%. The real driver is the stay-at-home order, sort of the shutdowns. So if you shut down airports or you shut down big commercial centers or you shut down industries, that has had an effect. Now, what's interesting is for about 80% of our business, that does not affect us because we're long-term contracted. So we're actually paid for capacity, just being available. And energy is usually a pass-through for us. So, you know, for most of our business, you know, the drop we had was mostly U.S. utilities. You know, we said that we expected a 5% drop for the year, but it's basically U.S. utilities. There's a lot of concern internationally. But given our particular business model, we're selling energy in dollars to big multinationals for the most part abroad. So it's not very affected by the crisis. Now, will it affect our strategy going forward? Well, look, we are in the midst of a transition to a much greener portfolio, you know, based on digital services, based on renewables and based on energy storage. So we have currently 70 projects under construction. We're actually currently building about 2 gigawatts of renewables, you know, under construction. And we have a backlog of almost, over five gigawatts of renewables. So we don't see a real change in that. And we think that we were coming out with a prefabricated cube energy storage unit, which is modular, and so it doesn't need outside construction. And we're also coming out with a prefab solar, which allows us to double the density per acre and construct it in half the time. So our strategy remains the same. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we might tinker on the side. Some markets may be stronger, some markets not so strong. But for example, energy storage in particular is very strong. And we're seeing new RFPs come out here in Virginia for 3 gigawatts. We have a transmission project in Germany, another RFP for 6 gigawatts. So to put it in perspective, you know, we have a backlog of 1.3 gigawatts of energy storage. So, you know, right now we have our hands full for 20 and 21.
So Mauricio, how about you? Is your strategy changing and has the virus impacted your kind of future, you know, construction and operations?
Yes, I mean, similar to what Andres mentioned, I mean, if you look at some of the big mega trends, not just in our sector, but in the economy as a whole, obviously the low carbon economy is paramount today, not just in the eyes of policymakers, but consumers. They appreciate and they want to do the right thing. Also, you know, we were talking about the digital economy, right? The digitization of everything. I actually believe that the Internet of Things is enabling the Internet of Electricity. We have now, you know, all connected appliances, thermostats, controls, and the empowerment of consumers today is unprecedented. We can actually control, you know, how we use electricity and from what sources we buy it. And then the final one, and we started to see it in apparel and perhaps content in terms of media content, consumers really want products that fit their lifestyle, that are special for them. I mean, if you think about, you know, the Netflixes and you know, every company that is providing a product and services that is personalized to you, that's something that we're starting to see on the electricity side. If you look at Texas, which has, you know, the most open retail market in the country, you're starting to see products and services that are custom made for the consumer. You know, free nights, free weekends, 100% renewable energy. So I do believe that this, you know, consumer empowerment plus technology and the need to decarbonize the economy, those three trends, you know, inform the strategic shift that we made about 4 years ago.
So do you think, maybe just stay with you for another minute, Mauricio, this idea, I'm sure both of you have heard, electrification of everything, you know, take some of the other primary energy sources, particularly oil, and convert some of those to electricity, for example, cars. How far can we go on that? And how bullish are you on that idea? Mauricio, start with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, today I think everybody appreciates that electricity is the foundation of our way of life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, during the pandemic, now more than ever, we appreciate and on what electricity does for us as a society. But I do think that there is an opportunity, because during COVID-19, it's impossible not to think about the climate change crisis. I mean, you have to draw some analogies between the two. And what are it's how we respond, you know, to returning back to the new normal, that I think is going to determine how do you, you know, the acceleration of this electrification of everything. You know, climate change is a crisis that we want to avert at all costs. And I think there is an opportunity to decarbonize our economy through electrification. So this is going to be something that I think regulators, policymakers, and industry participants are going to be looking at really hard. How do we decarbonize through electrification? This is going to be at the center of that conversation.
Yeah. So same question to you, Andres.
Well, I think it's interesting. I basically agree with what Mauricio said, but I would say that, you know, these last days of not having fossil fuel-based transportation, I think we've seen dramatic improvements in local air quality. So it's not only a global problem, it's a local problem in terms of noise as well. And it's very interesting. I think people in many cities are seeing blue skies, which they hadn't seen in decades, you know, specifically, for example, thinking of India. And I think that they're seeing what our world would be like if we had, say, 80% electric cars. So I really think that we're getting to costs of renewables that are really killer applications. Combine that with electrification of transportation. I do see that it would greatly improve people's quality of life. And when you think about downtowns, if you actually internalize some of the costs, you know, of the congestion and traffic and so forth and pollution, it would very much justify making a bigger change. But I also think that one thing that's going to come out of this, we're not going to go back to working as we did before. So I think, you know, we've closed our books, we've done everything with pretty much all of our back office staff at home. And I don't see a world where 100% of the people come back to the office. Now, that will have a lot of, you know, impact on real estate, on, you know, even toll roads, et cetera. I think, you know, the promises that people had in the past of working remotely via the internet or coming real or happening, it took a crisis to force us to change our behavior. So it's very interesting to think of how that's going to change. And again, I very much believe in the electrification of most everything.
So, you know, you have invested a lot in storage, primarily, I think, in large scale storage. Could you say a bit about, you know, your future outlook? How cheap could it get? And could we get very, you know, very cost-effective sure. EVs, for example, because of very cheap storage?
Well, you know, one of the big drivers was battery prices, mm-hmm. lithium-ion batteries, and they've come down 80% in the last 6 years. And I think they'll get even better and cheaper. We're working on the design and the balance of plant. I think there are advantages. For example, the instantaneous reaction that an energy storage unit has versus, say, a thermal peaking plant. The fact that you can locate them anywhere. Now, when you combine this with solar, you know, then you can really have a killer application. You know, we have batteries plus solar in Kauai that is really 24/7. So when people talk about the cost, it really depends what are you using it for. You know, it's one thing to have 1 hour batteries, it's another thing to have 8 hour batteries. That's where we're getting to. And when we talk about, say, even 8 or 5 hour batteries, that's at 100% discharge. So depending on the load shaping, you know, 5-6 hours of batteries, if you have an overbuilt solar, can give you 24/7 renewal. So that's really what we're talking about today. So we're seeing many new applications. We did inaugurating the world's first virtual reservoir. We have a run-of-the-river hydro in Chile. We put energy storage on it. And that way, you don't have to dispatch this electricity from, say, noon to 3 p.m. when energy prices are almost zero because there's so much solar. So, you know, really what energy storage can do is give you that capacity that intermittent renewables can't do. Now, you know, again, you still need other things in most systems. It's going to take a time to make the full adaption, but it has really come into its own. So I think it has so many applications that really I think that the main hurdle today is regulatory. You know, how do you get paid for everything you're doing? To give you an idea, say you're doing ancillary services or something like that. A battery's online 99.9% of the time. A peaking plant is typically on 10% of the time. So, you know, how do you get paid for all the additional things that energy storage can do? But it's a technology whose time has come.
So, Mauricio, how about you? Are there particular technologies you think, I mean, you've talked a lot about digitalization, other things you see will be really key to the future of the power business?
Yes, and let me just, because obviously Andres is, he's a leader in storage. And we see storage as one of those technologies. But we actually think about it in a slightly different way. I mean, he's developing it. But I think of NRG as an enabler of those technologies. I'm agnostic, you know, quite candidly, you know, to the cost that makes, you know, storage or other technologies. I am going to look at, you know, the most efficient to serve our customers. So, for example, last year in Texas alone, we gave contracts to close to 1.6 gigawatts of solar energy, new projects that are needed in the system that are being enabled by us, because without those contracts, those projects would not be able to be financed. So that's how I think about, you know, the storage. And I mean, we can have a conversation about the timing and when and the economics, but I think we all agree that whatever this transition is, it needs to be a transition that, you know, maintains the reliability, the resilience, the safety, but the affordability too, to consumers, equally important to clean. So we need to balance all these. Now, let me, you know, you ask about the technologies that I see, and I think of them on both sides of the equation, not just on the supply side of the equation, but also the demand side of the equation. And you know, we often talk about a future, you know, this four product future inside NRG. And we think of it in, you know, obviously renewables. Renewables are the cheapest form of generation today. Thanks to competition, innovation, we have driven the cost curve down. I see a continued increase of renewable energy. Obviously, storage is the new technology, and Andres can speak, you know, a lot, you know, in more detail about it. But we also think, you know, natural gas as a bridge fuel, it's an important component because you need the resilience and the reliability, particularly in an economy that is completely dependent now on electricity, a digital economy. I mean, can you imagine the reputational risk If you know, one of the large e-commerce companies, without naming, you know, their servers were down because there was no electricity? So I think that, you know, the value of reliability, you know, it has to be appreciated. And so far, we've enjoyed it. And it comes at a cost. So, you know, we need to be thinking about you know, what is this transition? And then the final one is the demand side. We refer to it as controllable demand. Consumers, technology is empowering consumers to use electricity in a completely different way. We talked about virtual power plants, right? With manufacturing facilities that can ramp down their consumption during peak times. So in effect, you're basically creating a virtual power plant during those times because they're not consuming. I mean, I always say that the cheapest cost megawatt is the one that you don't consume. And that's where controllable demand, becomes incredibly, incredibly powerful in this future that is going to rely more and more on intermittent generation like renewables and storage and some gas. But that's how I think about these technologies impacting our industry.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And actually, I think both of you are saying, you know, how the world is changing, and particularly post-COVID, sustainability and creating a sustainable future is going to be hugely important with the power of consumer. So before we wrap, I have a couple of questions. One is around your emission targets. Both of you have talked about emissions. So maybe I'll start with you, Andres. You still have a coal portfolio, and I think you have publicly announced a reduction of the emissions target. And I noticed, I actually grew up around coal mines, so I know this business a bit, that even Germany, which is very advanced, is having very big challenges in reducing their coal portfolio. How do you see that target fitting into your broader goal, and how difficult would it be to get to?
Well, we've announced that we want to have less than 30% of our gigawatt hours generated from coal starting next year.
Next year.
Mm-hmm. Next year. So we're moving very well in that direction. And, you know, again, like Mauricio said, what we're doing is combining things. Because, you know, it's not immediately you go to 100% renewable future. So what we've done, for example, in Chile, where we have coal plants, is what we call green blend and extend, where we build renewables and we dispatch those first. But then we will run actually our coal plant, you know, at night or when, you know, you need it as a backup. You need that capacity. But that allows you to reduce your gigawatt hours from coal, maybe 40%, you know, initially, right away. You know, in the future, you would replace that with perhaps just batteries and go 100% green. So our goal is to, you know, basically have phased out coal by 2030. So we see it as a transition. We see gas as part of that transition. But it has to be done intelligently, and it's not one size fits all. You know, it's different on islands than it is on continental places. It's different where you have a lot amount of hydro. So, you know, you have to be smart about how you do this transition and really orient it towards the consumer. And I think, you know, it's easy to come out and say, well, you must be 100% renewable, but that is most likely not cost efficient. And then there's a question of reliability. So I would take the corollary of saying that the cheapest energy is the one that you don't consume, but I'd also say that the most expensive energy is that which you don't have. And, you know, a lot of our focus is on doing things like providing reliability for data centers, for chemical plants. And that's why combining different sources of energy are critical. And also, you know, we have a digital company that serves 80 utilities in the U.S., which is 100 million households. And so a lot of that is seeing how you tailor your services to the customer, satisfying his needs, but also doing so in the most efficient way.
So, Mauricio, the same question, and I noticed that you have pretty ambitious carbon targets getting to net zero by 2050 and actually 50% down by 2025, which is kind of already here. So how do you plan to get to those targets?
Yes, well, I mean, our carbon reduction targets are very, very aggressive, but they are only one element of a comprehensive sustainability framework that we have in the company that I believe is foundational for any company to achieve long-term success. Environmental is important, but it's also, you know, social and governance. And we, you know, we can't forget about those when we're talking about the responsibility that we have as companies. Last year, we accelerated our carbon reduction goals. And I made the decision for two reasons. Number one, because we need to listen to scientists. When the UN came up with the recommendation that limiting global warming by 1.5 degrees was necessary to avoid the worst impact of climate change, we immediately, you know, were on board. And the second thing is because it completely aligns with our customers and what our customers want. So those two things were necessary, and I guess were inform our decision to accelerate those goals. Now, as you say, it's reducing our carbon emissions 50% by 2025 and net zero by 2050. Importantly, with a 2014 baseline, which already has the impact of the shale gas revolution, which, you know, already decreased significantly the carbon footprint of many of our industries. So when people go back, you know, more than, you know, a decade or so, you know, you really need to raise the ante. You need to have your baseline closer to where you are today. And, you know, applaud Andres for setting his baseline, you know, basically today. And the way we, you know, the way we have achieved, I mean, last week we actually published our 10th sustainability report. And in that, we report our progress. And I'm happy to tell you that we are already over 80% of the way to achieve our 2025 goal. That is just, from my perspective, I'm just incredibly proud of the organization that we are on a path to achieve that. And we are completely committed to be net zero by 2050. So how did we get there? And first is you need to invest capital. You need to invest capital in your portfolio, whether it is building renewables, whether it is, you know, we converted a significant amount of coal generation to natural gas, which by definition cuts our carbon footprint in half. Mm-hmm. And also it changes the utilization of those units. We have carbon capture and sequestration. We have a storage facility in Texas, and we continue to see storage as an option. Perhaps not, you know, with our capital, but enabling others by providing them contracts. The second thing is, it has been a change in utilization of our power plants. I mean, sometimes people tell me, "When are you going to retire coal plants?" And I said, "Those coal plants are not running anymore." Mm-hmm. We have them as an insurance product. They only run when it gets really cold or really hot to ensure that we have reliability in the system. So these plants used to run, you know, 70-80% of the time. Today they're running less than 10% of the time. But they give us the peace of mind to ensure that we maintain the reliability. And obviously, I mean, the last resource, which is always very difficult, you know, as a CEO of a company, is the retirement of plants. And we have retired a number of them. When there is no other alternative, we will retire those plants. So you can see that there is a combination of things that allows us to get there. Now, that's what has gotten us to where we are today. What I think is going to be the path going forward is continuing the digitization of our demand side of the equation, because I think there are a number of efficiencies in the system that we can achieve by doing that. We're going to continue to be on the supply side, but we're going to do it perhaps in a different way that we have done it in the past. Enabling developers, enabling companies, you know, to build renewable energy. We're going to continue with our coal to gas switching. And at some point, those coal units that were switched to gas that become peakers, at some point will retire. But we're going to do it in a responsible way, without jeopardizing what the electric sector gives us today in terms of, you know, resilience, reliability, affordability, and now clean energy.
Great. So it looks like you're well on the path to hitting those targets. So thank you for that. Thank you very much, Mauricio. Thank you very much, Andres. Very interesting conversation. Build back better and build a better world. And power business definitely is going to be in the front and center. And thank you again for joining us at this CERAWeek conversation presented to you by IHS Markit. Thank you to everybody who has been watching this.